most important bill. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. I know my committee isn't here, but I think that if I don't gavel in, they're not going to show up, so I'm gaveling in. But I do want to talk to you that because there is such interest on the rate setting for CCOs, I've eliminated the presentation on the upcoming Cadillac tax, as well as the update on the health insurance marketplace. So we will not be hearing those today. And then the last thing on our agenda, which I hope to start at about 4:15 or 4:30, is the presentation on ambulatory surgical centers. So with that, I will be in recess until I can get a quorum. Okay, we will resume the Senate Interim Committee on Health Care. Again, it is September 29th, and I will open an organizational meeting for the adoption of committee rules.
Madam Chair, I move adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9/29/15.
Senator Krug moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9/29/15. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just briefly, there was, I would have felt better if the changes would have been vetted with the Republican caucus before they were made, but other than that.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Any opposition? They are passed, and just to let you know, the last two items on the agenda have been eliminated, so we'll have more time for questions and comments on the rate setting. With that, I will open an informational hearing on the Coordinated Care Organization rate setting process, and would like to invite Lori Koiner, Zach Aders, and Mark Fairbanks to come forward to give us an overview. And while you're getting ready, I'll apologize. I have to leave at 3:40 for about 10 minutes, but I'll be right back.
And Chair, I have a couple of bill signings, so I'm going to be popping in and out.
It's bill signing day. Okay.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Fairbanks, and I am the Chief Financial Officer at the Oregon Health Authority. And today, I'm going to provide you a brief update on the financial information that's been provided by the CCOs, and then specifically describe the impact analysis that we have prepared to evaluate the impact of redeveloped rates effective January 1, 2015. And I think this brief presentation will set up some context to help and assist in the rest of the presentation that my colleagues will be making on rate development. So you have been provided with several pieces of information, financial information. Again, these are from the CCOs. We have a statewide, I'm just going to make some brief comments about this, and yes, and then zero in on the impact analysis. The statewide, you'll see that the statewide impact of the margin profile, actual margin profile, all the way through to our projection is, quite a bit larger in 2014. That's because of the impact of the ACA population in that year in 2014. You have graphical presentations that will show the individual margins by CCO year over year and CCO to CCO, including also a graph on the medical loss ratio, which is the relationship of direct medical expenses to direct medical revenue, and also the profile of the cash and investment status as of March 31, 2015, first quarter. We have just completed the 2015 quarter two information. We're finalizing that, and we expect to post it next week. But I can tell the committee that rolling it forward, the information with the actual quarter two, has a de minimis impact on the margin profile that we have displayed here on our analysis. You will see, you will note that the CCOs had a positive margin, all of them, for the first quarter of this year. I'd like to point your attention now to the slide that is talking about the impact of the 2015 rate redevelopment. And you'll notice that we've listed all of the CCOs and we have estimated the margin for the year 2015. It's important to note that that estimate is based on the quarter one actual results and assumes that the expense relationships for medical expense and administrative costs remains the same throughout the year. We've had one CCO contact us, and I would expect others to do so over the coming days and weeks to fine-tune the estimates. They are the ones that have the visibility to their contracts and their actual operating realities. So I'd like to point out that Willamette Valley, Bill Guest has run the numbers and has indicated that instead of a possible 9% or an estimated 9% margin, they would expect that to be closer to 3%, and that's because of their provider contracts. It's because the increase that they expect here in these redeveloped rates would flow through to their medical expense. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about the context for this. I've mentioned how it was derived, and its basis is to give us some level of a proxy or an approximation for an impact. You will notice that overall there's a $13.4 million increase statewide for the CCO rate adjustment that's being that has been developed and that my colleagues will talk about. That represents 0.03% of the total revenue for the CCOs for that time period, so less than 0.5%. The two, I'd call them outliers. You can see some of the variability that occurs based on size and operating model and a variety of factors. We have family care having a decrease of $55 million, and Willamette Valley would be the largest increase at 35.1. Those represent 8.5% in the case of Willamette Valley of their total revenue, expected revenue, excuse me, and the family care $55 million represents about 10.3% of net revenue for that CCO. So as you can see, there are 10 CCOs that would expect an increase and 6 with a decrease. The profitability profile, the margins, are listed on the right column. Family care is slightly over 1%, close to break even, while you'll see the spread that exists with the others. The last comment I'd like to make is that the analysis indicates that there are sufficient reserves, which is one of the key metrics we look at quarterly for the CCOs for liquidity, for those who are getting a decrease to transition. But for any CCO that has a cash flow issue, we are ready to assist them in allowing a sufficient time for the recruitment to occur. So with that, I would turn it over to my colleagues.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and the committee. For the record, my name is Lori Coyner. I'm Director of Health Analytics for the Oregon Health Authority. I'm going to start with some opening remarks, and then the presentation will be a mix of Zach, who I'm going to have introduce himself next, and then we'll be going back and forth through the presentation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Zach Gatter, Senior Actuary for Optimus Consulting. And what we'd like to present to you today is give you a walkthrough of not only the rate methodology, but some of the nuances and insights into both some of the assumptions, observations, and data that have gone into the rate development. The slide that we have pulled up right now, we're going to start with this because I think it's an important nuance in our discussions of the rate development. It has been mentioned in other meetings that we want to ensure that the rate development process is not just including fee-for-service data. And in fact, this slide shows that we take extensive measures to make sure that we're including the total financial expenditures of all CCOs in the rate development. What is shown on the screen is the profile of those expenditures for the most recent base data that was used in the current rate setting process. And as you can see, approximately 77% of those expenditures would be classified as encounters, 16% as subcapitation, and 7% as incentive or other payments. And I think it's an important perspective to keep in mind as we walk you through how we then took these expenditures and developed a rate.
So I'm going to walk through, just like I said, a little bit of a high-level overview about where we were in 2012 and 2014, which was the beginning of the waiver period. What's unfolded for 2015 and 16, and then where we plan to go. Part of this is to get a conceptual view of the things that have changed during this time period, as well as what the next steps are. So I think I'll start by saying that we don't envision this rate redevelopment as the end, but really as one step in a process that's going to be moving forward. So before the expansion population was included as part of the Oregon Health Plan. So for 2012 and 2014, many of you were here, and we adopted a global budget. And what that means is that we started to provide payments to coordinated care organizations that included funding for physical health and mental health, and then eventually rolled on dental services as well. So when we speak about global budget, what we really mean is that we combined many different funding streams and put them into a single, what we call per member per month payment for the CCOs, so that they could more easily manage their own budgets. We also had a cost template methodology. That was the methodology used to compute the rates, and our internal actuary signed those rates. But the cost template methodology allowed the CCOs much more freedom in terms of estimating and providing the trend assumptions and those sorts of things in the rate determination. And CCO-specific rates were developed. This was moving along pretty smoothly until the game changer happened, and that was really the implementation of the Affordable Care Act expansion population. And part of the reason that changed the landscape is that the federal government was funding all of these new enrollees, and they consist now of about a third of all of the Oregon Health Plan, or third of the enrollees for the coordinated care organizations. And because they were funding those individuals, there became much more scrutiny on the dollars and the rates. And Zach's going to talk a little bit more about the evolution of that. So it became apparent, we were told by CMS in a notice of corrective action that we received in July of 2014, that we needed to move away from the cost template methodology and move toward an actuarially sound process that included encounters and other financial data like that Zach just discussed in the previous slide. Moving forward, what we plan to do, and let me back up. So this move and requirement by CMS to adopt the actuarial standards of practice and follow their new guidelines has made it more difficult, though not impossible, to continue with this idea of a global budget and a sustainable rate of growth. So what the work moving forward is to, we've engaged Manat as a consulting firm, along with Optimus, to review strategies that will allow us to continue to move towards a sustainable rate of growth, continue to count subcapitation and incentive payments, and not just fee-for-service payments, so that we're moving in a direction that supports alternative payment strategies as well as efficiency. We plan to do that in collaboration with the CCOs, and we will be submitting a amendment to our waiver that outlines in more detail what that will look like. Next slide.
Madam Chair, can I ask you a quick question? So the email traffic between you and the consultants as you're developing the rates, is that public record?
Chair Monis-Anderson and members of the committee, yes, it is.
And follow-up, have there been public records requests of that information?
Chair Monis-Anderson and the committee, yes. I don't know off the top of my head whether it was a public records request for all of those. We have had public records requests around the rate setting process. We do have a litigation, and so we've had a production request for all of those emails.
Last follow-up. So when those public records requests have come in, have you supplied the records that have been requested?
Chair Monis-Anderson and the members of the committee, yes, we have.
Please proceed. I know you have to leave at 3.
Chair Monis-Anderson and members of the committee, Zach Adders was going to be on a plane this afternoon, but he's changed his flight so that he will be here both today and tomorrow because of the importance of this discussion.
Thank you very much. Okay, that's good to know.
So this graph just shows, this is the biennial average, so that's why we show a little 1% of the state share for the expansion population, but this emphasizes the amount of federal dollars that we're receiving for our health system transformation and coordinated care organizations. So you'll see in this ACA rates group, because of those 99% of federal funding for the 2015 to 2017 biennium, the CMS has a very strong focus on what the rates are for that particular subpopulation. Next slide. And I'm not going to walk through all of these bullets on this particular slide, and just focus on the bottom bullet. I've shown you the dollars, and CMS and the Office of the Actuary have increased their guidance around how rates need to be set for the expansion population. And I'm going to let Zach walk through the history around this, just so that you understand why those guidelines have been changed and are more heavily scrutinized.
So a little bit of background around the increased oversight. The catalyst here was really the expansion. And as Lori alluded to, the reason for the oversight is because when the expansion entered into the various Medicaid programs around the nation, it was a federal dollar at risk, full federal dollar. And not only were the rates significantly high, as we'll see later on in the slides, but it was a significant portion of the caseload growth across all states, across the nation. So there was a lot of concern around the methodology that was being used to develop these rates. What happened was at random, the GAO did an audit on several of the rate developments across the nation, had some questions around some of the methodologies that they encountered. And the outcome of that was additional guidance, technical guidance. The first of the documents was released in 2014. And really it was surrounding what was expected of any state or actuary when developing a rate for the expansion population. One of the unique things about the expansion population at that time was there was no data on the expansion population. So the states and the actuaries are being asked to set a rate with little to no experience. There was a lot of theories as to what acuity level the expansion would look like. Some anticipated that that population would be very chronic and have a lot of pent-up demand. Others anticipated that population would be young and healthy. Now that we have the benefit of time, and you'll see in later slides, we know that it was the latter that has actually, that we're seeing in the emerging data. They are actually younger and healthier, and that's being supported by the actual expenditures being reported when you compare to the rates that are originally set. So a lot of that just lays the groundwork. Some of the guidance that was out there that we're expected to uphold to is that knowing that the rates were set with little to no experience, in that 2014 guidance, it clearly states that the states and the actuaries should explore emerging data as it becomes available. And if it's determined that projection error is significant in the expansion rates, that corrections should be made. And that's really what we have done in this existing rate cycle, where we have taken 2014 data and the first 3 to 4 months of 2015 and investigated that data to really get a reasonable estimate of what the ultimate level of this population as far as expenditures and risk will look like. And we'll cover that in later slides. The last piece before we move on in the additional oversight is that now all of the rate submissions that the states submit to CMS are actually reviewed by third-party actuaries. And there's a session of Q&As that go back and forth. And the real purpose behind that is to ensure that all actuarial standards of practice are at least considered somewhere in the rate methodology, and in essence serve as some level of peer review from one actuary to another.
So we've set the stage for from the federal perspective, I think. And the next question is, why did we choose to redevelop rates in the middle of or at the beginning of 2015 for calendar year 2015. I will say that it was not a decision that was made lightly. We had received the corrective action from CMS and had internal actuary compute the rates. They were delivered to the coordinated care organizations on December 24th of 2014, very little time for them to review. As a result of that and the resulting variation that was noted in the rates, the coordinated care organizations sent a letter to former Governor Kitzhaber with a list of concerns, and they're highlighted here on this slide. The three main are that there was variation or variance between the CCOs that wasn't explained. They didn't understand why two different CCOs within a region would have different rates. There was a lack of transparency in how the rates were developed, and the CCOs expressed concern that they were not asked to provide input in the process. And then some concerns around this actuarial soundness. We also, in March, received the first round of questions from these original rates. There were 103 questions. We had consulted at that time with Optimus, and they expressed that this was a very large number of questions relative to other states where they work. And Lynn Saxton, Director Saxton, held a meeting with the CCOs to talk about the issues. And it was then decided to redevelop the rates. And at that time, we did not have a decision about what the effective date of those rates would be. Once the rates were complete, we met with CMS on two different occasions by phone. We had been briefing them, I believe, two times as we underwent the rate redevelopment process to vet the methodology, let them know what we were doing, and keep them apprised. But they were unwilling to give us any guidance about effective date until they had an opportunity to understand where we were landing with the new rates. When they found out that the rates were quite, these new redeveloped rates were quite different, and we'll show you where there are swings between both CCOs and the Affordable Care Act population, the expansion, and the standard traditional. They were unwilling to certify two sets of rates in 1 year unless they yielded the same results, and we couldn't provide that. So we were therefore told to make those rates retroactive, which we communicated with the CCOs in August. Next slide. So that gives the background kind of where we are. I'm going to turn over some of the discussion to Zach to talk more specifically about the methodology that we came up with through this 8-month process of redevelopment.
Okay. So this slide, we've already mentioned the phrase quite a few times in this presentation, actuarial soundness, and I think it's important to really discuss what is that. The first thing I'd like to address is actuarial soundness does not negate the idea of sustainable growth and the vision that is in the Oregon program. In fact, if followed, actuarial soundness lays a great foundation for its success, and we will see that in future rate cycles. The key piece here is that actuarial soundness is really just a process that is embedded in our professional principles, actuarial standards of practice, guidelines, and all it is, it just helps us evaluate the risk of any particular program. And that's really all we're doing here. We are not coming at this where we have a predetermined outcome, because if you go down that path, you really never understand the true risk of your program. So what we've done and what we were asked to do is evaluate the true risk of the program, bring that evaluation to the table, and let's see how that compares with this whole idea of sustainable growth. Some of our observations and findings I think you'll find interesting, and we show them in the slides forthcoming.
But doesn't that mean that you're rewarding those who provide expensive services?
Not at all. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I know that's a common thought, and I hear that a lot, but that's why I opened up with the remarks. Actuarial soundness does not mean the idea of just counting services. The very first slide that we showed was the fact that we're including all expenditures, incentives, subcapitation, and fee for service. Not only are we including all services, but we have multiple touch points and discussions with each CCO to understand their business model and not only their financial risk, but the external risk that they're up against, provider contracting, location. There's a lot more that goes into actuarial sound rates than just calculating averages and summing up numbers. So the short answer to your question is this does not reward those that overutilize. In fact, if followed, again, with care, it helps you identify those that are being efficient and identify those that are not. Okay, before we get into more of the details, this is just, again, to give you a framework of how we think, and we'll hopefully shed some light into my response to the last question, and that is, how do we go about a rate setting process? And we refer to this as four determinants of risk, and we take this approach with every rate setting exercise that we do. And it basically boils down to the who, what, where, and how. It's as simple as that, but it gets more complex very quickly. And basically what that is population. Who's being covered? Who are they? What are their risk profiles? How do they differ? What type of external influences are going on in the economy that can impact them in the future? The services. What kind of Medicaid benefits are they eligible for? And what do they utilize? And this is an important one for the Oregon program. Regional. Where are these individuals receiving their care? Where do they reside? What care is available to them? It gets to the point of the whole access to care. Again, another aspect of actuarial soundness that goes beyond just summing and averaging. And then finally, the delivery system. Again, this is an important one for your program because you have 16 CCOs, all different sizes and different business models. And the difference in business models sometimes drives differences in utilization in the way that the care is provided. So certainly we have to consider that as well.
So when we began the rate redevelopment process, we wanted to focus our attention on the identified issues that were brought forward by the CCOs. So we you'll see we wanted to match payment to risk. How does that address the CCOs' concerns? Well, that is the one way that we can reduce variability long term and to make sure that the payments that we're making matched the risk of the population, meaning that if a CCO happens in a particular year to have more members with chronic disease, then it's going to cost them more to take care of those members than a CCO that has many fewer. We also, this improved credibility, what does that mean? Well, CCOs vary in size, and some are quite small when we think about a rate-setting process. So we wanted to reduce any swings that might happen just because of the small size of the CCO from year to year so that we get towards the sustainable rate of growth. It's part of the reason also that we adopted a regional approach so that we can minimize variability both between the CCOs and from year to year. We've worked very hard to improve transparency in the rate development process. We hold weekly actuarial calls where the CCOs, internal actuaries and consulting actuaries have an opportunity to look at the models that Optimus is working on, provide feedback. There are many instances where feedback was given. Optimus would go back, rerun numbers, come back to the group and in some instances change their approach based on the feedback. We also held monthly rates work group meetings. Those were attended largely by each CCO's CEO and CFO. They're open to any people that the CCOs wanted to bring. And then we've had over 100 individual meetings with the CCOs. That's one-on-one meetings. Many times Optimus is here in person to talk about the rate setting process. So the first meetings were to look at their financial information, compare it with three different sources to ask questions to understand where the data comes from, and then continue to meet along the whole process. And finally, we needed to ensure that the methodology will be approved by CMS. And that what that means is that we needed to be consistent with the new guidance from CMS and the Office of the Actuary. And finally, and Zach has already spoken to this, is we needed to look at the expansion population rates now that we had 2014 data, look at it, see where we were, compare it with the experience that happened in 2014, and compare it to the rates that were paid and make any necessary adjustments.
Okay. As we progress through these slides, we're going to use the term rating region. So we've included a slide to show you what we mean. One of the four determinants of risk that I discussed talked about the where, and this addresses that. So you have 16 very different CCOs that operate in different parts of the state. Each of them have different business models, contracting, available hospitals, and that certainly will dictate the way that care is provided and the expenditures that are reported, because if the hospitals that are available to that particular CCO are more of the AB hospitals, then costs, all else being equal, those costs are going to be higher than if they had a DRG hospital, so you know, such as, you know, more in line with an urban area. So the idea here is to divide the state up into regions that will accommodate or group like populations and CCOs together. This is one area where through that iterative process and that transparent process, the state benefited, and so did the methodology. We brought what we thought was a reasonable proposal, but we came with an open mind. And we said, here's one of a proposal. We'd like to solicit feedback from the broader group. We did solicit that feedback, and the proposal was to move to 4 rating regions instead of the 3 that we had proposed. And we took that back, did the analysis, and it did improve the numbers. So we did move forward with the 4 rating regions that were proposed, not just by Optum and the state, but by the stakeholders and the CCO groups as a whole.
Madam Chair?
Yes. No.
Thank you. Is it Zach?
Yes.
Zach. So who set the 4 regions?
Are you referring to who had the suggestion from the CCOs, or who ultimately?
Yeah, who ultimately made the decision? How the 4 regions were divided for rate setting?
At the end of the day, with the certification, it's my signature on the certification, so that decision would be part of that certification. But it's not made in a silo. It's made with agreement from the state, and in this case, agreement from the CCOs.
Madam Chair, it just seems to me that there's some extreme variations in some of those regions as it relates to the differences, and I just don't know how you can square that with the divisions that have been made. So,
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure the variations that are being referred to, but I'm happy to address those if
in terms of cost.
Yes. Okay.
An operation.
The cost, definitely there's a difference, and I'll give you an example. If you don't use rating region, and I will refer to a TANF population. It's a non-expansion population. It's a staple population of the Medicaid program. It has been in existence since the inception of Medicaid. If you go statewide, the variance that you speak of is significant, and in fact, there is no rate range that would encapsulate that variance. The variance is in the neighborhood of about 40% from your high to low CCO. Now, there are drivers through that variance, and if you're looking at the cost or the rates on a sheet without having access to the drivers, I think it is a bit puzzling on what exactly is going on. But one of the drivers is going to be the AB hospital utilization that I spoke of. That's one reason that rating regions are necessary. The second region is going to be just the risk of the population, and actually that's our next slide, so I won't spend too much talking about that. But certainly there's going to be a different mix in risk, even if you're talking about TANF population between the various CCOs, and it's the same population. There are different risk of profile. The profile risk of each member is very different. And depending on what type of risk profile and aggregate a CCO ends up with can drive the differences in costs as well. And then lastly, of course, is just the way that the CCO directs the care certainly will impact that. But those are three areas that could impact variance that you would see if you're just comparing rates.
Sure. So, Madam Chair, so I'm one of the non-providers on the committee. Doctor, nurse, cigarette salesman, and married to a provider, and then doctor. So I guess I'm a payer. That's all I am. So I probably have the least understanding of the mechanics. So I've been listening to you guys, really been trying to pay attention. So if I understand this right, and correct me if I'm wrong, CMS said that we had to take corrective action because the rates were off. Right so far? I'm getting heads shaking yes. So CMS told OHA to make the rates retroactive. Is that right? Because that's what I heard.
Madam Chair and the rest of the committee, yes, though that's a later step in the process. So the we had multiple forces saying redevelop rates, and then once we redeveloped them, we had to say, well, when are they going to start? And that's what I meant by effective date. And then, yes, CMS wanted us to take those rates and go back to the beginning of the year.
Okay, so I'm a small business guy pretty much my entire life, either owned them or managed them. So I'm trying to figure out how, because I think a lot of these essentially are run as small business models, at least in the outlying areas. I assume that it's a bigger business in the metro area, but still a business. So how is it that these businesses are supposed to be able to make up that kind of money in a retroactive period and in, by the end of the year? Is that when they're supposed to make it up?
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, when Mark presented, so I'm just going to go back to that, and Mark may want to jump in, but how many of the CCOs received an increase?
Ten
of the CCOs received an increase. We will be making those payments before the end of the year at their request so that they can manage their books. The CCOs that require a recoupment, we can do that by the end of the year. We have also given them the option to take that longer into 2016, and we will work with them around that. So, and that's on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, I mean, Madam Chair, follow up. Yeah, but we're still talking about real money, regardless of how you spread it out. I mean, I've paid credit card bills before, so I understand that. And you can spread them out, but it's still, some of these numbers are pretty large. So what kind of impacts are we talking about on the CCOs from essentially these paybacks or retroactivity?
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, the handout that Mark Fairbanks walked you through, I think, let me show you. It looks like this, just so you know. There's a page 7, and on that page, it shows the estimated margin after the payments are reconciled.
Okay, so follow up. So why is OHA setting margins?
We aren't setting margins. We are just estimating them. These would be estimated through the end of the year, but we receive financial information from the CCOs, and I'm going to let Mark speak more to that.
Yes, thank you for that question, Senator. Mark Fairbanks, Madam Chair in the committee. This exercise was not intended to set rates. We don't set rates for CCOs. Not rates. I'm talking about margin. What this did was we decided that, you know, as part of the process to do the due diligence, to look at the landscape, look at each of the CCOs, look at all of them in total, look at them individually, based on their financial profile, make a conservative projection, look at what would happen to margin, look at their relative stability in terms of their solvency, their liquidity, and their available cash reserves, and could they sustain this? And it is our opinion that in almost all cases, those with a decrease can make this transition. If not, as Lori pointed out and I mentioned earlier, we will work with them to spread the recoupment out to a period of time that they could better accommodate it from cash flow. I'd also share with the committee that in my experience, activity of CMS that flows through the states on Medicaid rates and Medicare, and I know physician reimbursement sometimes will be retroactive. It's not necessarily to this magnitude because we're talking about what I believe is a level set year. And I personally would not expect to see this kind of activity short of some major shift in federal policy, or state policy for that matter, for this kind of an event. I think this is an episode, and I think that Zach's going to talk about a little bit of 2016 development and what that is already indicating to us in terms of the stability of the model.
Yeah, so follow up, Madam Chair. So, yeah, Katrina was an episode. So my question really is what's the impact to the CCOs? Because, I mean, my understanding, again, business guy. So I have a budget for the year. I'm working off of that budget. I get 9 months into the year, and somebody says, hey, guess what? You know what you're getting paid for? You're not getting paid. As a matter of fact, we need to take money back from you. That to me sounds like a serious episode. So, you know, is this a puddle in a parking lot, or is this a Katrina type event for these CCOs? I mean, that's really what I'm trying to get at.
Yes, and based on our proxy, we believe that yes, it's not a, I'd say, a very pleasant event, but it is one that we think that the CCOs are able to sustain.
And I just need to follow up on that, because I know in 2014 in their rates that they knew, the CCOs knew before 2014 that what rates they were going to have. And that's why, and when I look at what the insurance division does, they come out with their rates for the carriers for the following year. And so that's one of the things that I'm struggling with, that you would implement a rate retroactively to January when they've already didn't have time to adjust to this change that really affects their business model. So in my mind, it makes better, yes, work on your methodology, but certainly not go retroactively, go prospectively to January 2016.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that discussion is more in line with policy, but it does relate to an actuarial perspective that I think is important here, and that is, I mentioned earlier in the presentation that the rate submissions are reviewed by a third-party actuary that is a contractor of the federal government. That dictates whether the rates get approved. Upon approval, essentially the actuary, Office of the Actuary, that approves those rates is taking on the same responsibility as I did when I signed those rates. And that means that they're bound by all of the applicable actuarial standards of practice to ensure that those rates are appropriate for the population being covered. Now, again, we have some forthcoming slides that are going to show you some numbers, but the dilemma is going to be that if you put two sets of rates in front of an actuary and you tell them to certify those, and one of them is at least twice as high as the other, I'm not sure how that actuary defends that both are actuarially sound and appropriate for the services and populations in question. And that therein is the dilemma.
Madam Chair and the members of the committee, to add on to Zach's point, CMS has to certify the rates. And we believed at the time when we made this very tough decision to redevelop the rates that they were not going to certify the rates, that the Office of the Actuary had so many significant concerns that they would not be certified, because, and then what that does is put all those federal dollars in jeopardy. And after redeveloping the rates, CMS again said, we have significant concerns with your original rates, and we will not certify those and this new set together, and therefore you need to go back to January 1st. So it's not something that we chose to do, but a mechanism that we have to do in order to ensure that CMS will certify the 2015 rates.
And we have that in writing from CMS that says that they will deny payment for the expansion population?
There is a letter that's included in your packet from CMS, but it does not go so far to say they will deny payment of expansion.
Proceed.
Thank you. Okay. The next slide is going to get into really the backbone of the methodology. And one of the ideas here is we already have shown the regions, and now what we're going to discuss is the risk score and explained variance. The question was brought up earlier about when you look at a rate sheet or expenditures in a particular region, what's some of the drivers between? Why are they so different? And one of the differences is really what is shown up on the screen. And really, just visually, I'll just explain what this is. I won't get caught up in the numbers on the axes. But basically what this represents is the old adage that 20% of your population make up 80% of your spend. That's just a rule of insurance. It's really why insurance exists. And that holds true in the Medicaid program. And what this shows is that as you progress left to right, on the left-hand side, those are going to be individuals that have a low risk score. A risk score is a tool. It's an assessment tool that is used nationwide. in Medicare, in commercial markets, and in Medicaid markets. And what it does, it identifies individuals with chronic illnesses, and it gives them a score based on those chronic illnesses, in addition to giving them a score based on their demographics, what age band, what gender that they are. And so you would expect someone with a low risk score to have low annual expenditures. This is what this graph shows. As you move left to right, you can see that it's sloping. And off to the right-hand tail of this, those are members with the highest risk score, and you can see they have extremely high spend. So if you were to carve this graph up, you would find that it is true that about 20% of the population make up 80% of the spend. So now I go back to the question that was asked, what drives the differences? Also, a secondary question that we've been asked, isn't a TANF population a TANF population? If I operate in the same region, don't I get the same risk? This will hopefully provide insight into the answer that it's no, because you will only get the same risk if you get the same percentage of that 20% that really is the driver of the cost. And the chances of that happening, particularly when you're talking about 4, 5, or 6 CCOs operating in a region, not likely. And that's actually what we've seen in the risk score assessment. And that's why, one of the reasons why you see variance if you're just looking at reported expenditures or the rate sheets that we've developed. So the next slide tries to really get at what the risk score is doing. The comment on variance, this is going to show you exactly how that is intertwined in the rates. Absent of risk factor in this example, and this is an actual example for the TANF cohort for the Tri-County rating region, and it encapsulates family care and health share. The regional PMPM for this population is $317.53. So all else being equal, both entities would receive that amount to cover the population. And again, without further inspection, you would think that may be appropriate. But upon further investigation, what you'll see is when you evaluate the risk score, family care actually has a significant lower risk score. A number below 1 means healthier than normal. A number above 1 means more chronic or sicker than normal. So in this case, you can see that family care has a risk score of 0.94, health share has a risk score of 1.03, and what we do then is apply that to the regional, and then that creates the variance that you will see in the rates that we've developed, so that family care will receive $299.20, health share will receive $328.07. Going back to one of the first slides, this is really the undertone of trying to match payment to risk, because without some kind of tool to do this, what you're going to the unintentional consequence would be to overpay one plan and underpay another.
But don't you think that you've used what, 3 months of 2015?
For the expansion population, and I think that's a nuance here.
But this is for based on 2014?
This is for the non-expansion, so this would be 2014 data.
Right.
Yes.
And so with the expansion, don't you think you need more time to make sure that your baseline rate is really what you're projecting that it should be?
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a great question. In fact, it's one that we thought of as well as we're developing the rates. So let's take a step back. The 2014 rates were developed with no data. There was none. We're in today. We have the first year of data, and we have the first year of 2014, and we have the first quarter of 2015 for the expansion population. Again, taking at face value, one may think that 15 months of data is appropriate. But in fact, you need to understand that the expansion population, they didn't just all enroll in the program as of the start of the year. They came in throughout the year. And that's borne out by, if you look at their average duration, which by definition is the number of months that they're enrolled in the program, it's about 4.5 to 5.5 months of duration. It's fairly low. And if you compare that to a control group such as TANF, a more, you know, again, a population that's been around for a while, their average duration will be anywhere from 9.5 to 10.5 months, and that's about average for any population that's been enrolled and stabilized. So the idea here is that once we've seen that, we had the same thought and the same comment is, let's be careful on using 2014 data, emerging data, but it does give us more information than we had when the rates were set with no data, right? While it may not indicate where the ultimate level of expenditures lay, it certainly is better information than was available previously. And so what we did is we actually took the 2014 data, and we'll actually show this on a slide, but we added some conservatism to it. We call it a durational adjustment. We increased it by 5 to 10% just from the fact that it had a low duration. So it increases it to get to your point that we didn't necessarily trust it at face value. We think that it could go higher. In addition to that, the expansion population has a higher trend than the non-expansion. So that when you project that into
higher trend, higher
utilization, when we set rates, we have to project it out into a time period, and you do that by using trend. And the trend that we use for expansion is slightly higher than non-expansion, again, to try to accommodate potentially some pent-up demand and some of the unknown risk that may still yet to be observed or as the dust settles on the expansion.
Senator Shield has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a little puzzled by, there seem to be six different ways you're trying to show some validity to these numbers. So the expansion population has basically been set aside in the metropolitan area, Portland metropolitan region, and you're just dealing with the previous cohorts. And I guess one thing that I'm a little puzzled with, too, is, you know, as you look at those two CCOs in the region, you have one that is trying to focus primarily on primary care and putting a big focus there. And then you have another one that is the majority of which are hospital systems. Can you tell me how you took into account those two different factors? And my thoughts are also that the one that focuses on primary care and accessibility in primary care offices might attract more infants. And I was thinking that infants are more likely to be in the emergency room. So I was wondering is, you know, you talk about how the variance is explained, but there's really nothing in here that tells us the methodology or what those risk factors were. And I think I would like to see that. And I'd also like to see any type of validated explanation of this CDPS-RX. Is there anything in the literature that validates it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there's an endless supply of documents and validation for the various risk tools, CDPS plus RX being one of many. Certainly, we could provide some documents that speak to that. To your comment on the...
Could you send that to the professional staff and we can distribute it?
Yes. To your comment on validating the rates in six different ways, this is a very complex process. So I think one... thing that I should make clear is that we develop rates on a rating cohort basis. So the reason that we're speaking of ACA and then jumping to TANF is because those are very two different rating cohorts. When we certify rates, we're certifying the rate for each individual rating cohort for a program. We're not just certifying the aggregate rate that a lot of times you will see on a financial projection. That really has no bearing in our certification. We are actually certifying the expansion rate, the TANF rate, the child to 6 to 18 rate. And to your point, we also have rate cohorts that address the infants. So how was the different delivery systems addressed? Certainly that comes through in the data that's provided. I'm going to relate that to the risk scores because I think it's relevant. Whether you're a CCO that has a focus on primary care or you're a CCO that has a focus on hospital type services, if I am an individual that has rheumatoid arthritis and I go to the doctor, whether it's a physician or a hospital, I'm going to have a claim that is going to get picked up by that tool that says I have rheumatoid arthritis. It does not matter if I went to the hospital, to outpatient or physician, because I'm going to end up taking pharmaceuticals to address the issue as I go to my physician to get treated. So the individual that would get assigned a risk score would get assigned the same risk score in both of those entities. And so to get at your the question on, you know, how they treat the care, I think that's where efficiencies come into play. And if one CCO can treat it more efficiently than the other, then they're actually going to be able to provide the care at a lower rate than what the premium would indicate, and therefore get rewarded for that efficiency.
Okay, follow up. So I understand that for a large number of these populations, but then with the ACA expansion, you basically said we're going to set aside what we know about the validity rating, and we're just going to kind of do an average of what the cost is. But if the average on a region that only has two CCOs is very high for one, and that doesn't really seem to be using the risk factors. It's
sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the intent here is to use risk score in the future for the expansion population, but for the very reason that I explained, that we did not trust the 2014 expenditures at face value to reflect the starting point as a rate development, because we had to, because of the low duration. Low duration creates bias and can skew risk adjustment numbers as well. So you cannot use risk adjustment with any type of certainty and apply it to develop the rate, because just for the fact that it has a low duration, those risk scores could change. And so that was a point of discussion with the larger group. The work groups, the touch points, definitely discussed on the actuarial user group calls, and there was consensus for the other consulting actuaries representing CCOs that participate in those, that it was probably better to wait to use that risk score tool until that duration of the expansion population gets a bit more mature, and we certainly want to run that. That being said, we have ran the risk score on the population, so we do have those numbers, and it does bear out in the case of the Tri-County area that, again, the population for family care has a significantly lower risk score than that of health share. We did not use that information. We used it just internally so we can, again, observe and set the stage and understand the program. But we certainly did take a look at that.
And Chair Monis-Anderson and members of the committee, we can provide a handout that shows those risk scores if you'd like.
Okay. Last question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Can you explain the relativity cost factor? What is that?
Yeah, absolutely. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the relative cost factor really is in lieu of using a risk factor. What we need to do is we're certifying a regional rate, but we have to have a way to then break apart that regional rate to attribute the cost back to each CCO. So the relative cost factor is basically taking the costs that were reported by each of the CCOs for their expansion population, and we're using that as a starting point to develop the rates before we do the durational adjustment and project it forward. So if you boiled that down, essentially what the relative cost factor does, it just gets that regional cost back to the costs that family care and health share reported for their expansion population in their financial template.
Proceed.
And that's actually a good segue into the slide that we have up right now. And this is going to show you really what we've been talking about and hopefully provide insight into why we have that dichotomy between ACA and non-ACA, because I know that gets a little cumbersome talking about two different rate setting processes within one. But as we have shown here, family care, this is again Tri-County region, family care is the top, health share is the bottom. The calendar year 14 rate is the actual premium that each of the plans were receiving. I'm just going to talk off of the total ACA line. So for family care, they received $516.08 per member per month for on average for each expansion member that they had. Health share received $494. Remember that those are the rates that were developed with no data. They were developed with theory, and no one really knew if the individuals were going to be chronic or healthy. So therefore, they're on the high side. The reported PMPMs for the same time period, now that we have the benefit of looking back and seeing some emerging experience, Family Care reports 233.10, HealthShare reports 286.26. Now, if you compare that 233.10 to the 516.08, that gets to my comment earlier, where if you're going to ask an actuary to defend a rate that is that much higher than what the actual experience or emerging experience indicates, that you really would need to understand some of the drivers behind that. And now that's going to lead me to the last column on the right. When I said we did not just use the 14 experience at face value, we actually inflated it for the durational impact, and we also have an increased trend higher than the non-expansion population. So for Family Care, the aggregate rate that we set for 15 comes in at 362.14 compared to the reported expenditures of 233.10 for 14. So my point in telling you that is that we did build some conservatism in the expansion rates. It does account for a significant annual increase year over year, to address the comment earlier that maybe we don't know where the dust is going to settle on the expansion. So we are being conservative. We just know more than we did when the original 14 rates were set, and those were set too conservatively. And I guess the last point that I will make is that, again, the 2014 technical guidance that I mentioned earlier in the conversation, it is the expectation of OAC and CMS that the states and the actuaries involved review actual emerging experience and make appropriate adjustments when projection error is significant. And in this case, projection error was significant.
Does profitability come into this at all?
Madam Chair, members
Seems
of the committee.
Seems like those that had the highest net profits were the CCOs that had the largest cuts. And I'd like to understand, and maybe that's going to come. Is that going to come?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can certainly speak to that and hand it over to Mark and Lori. The short answer is the actuarial sound process of setting the rates does not directly involve reviewing profitability or influenced by any type of budgetary restriction. My opening comments were the actuarial sound process is really about evaluating the risk. And then once we have done that, we then bring it to the finance team, which then compares our results to actual financial results, and what you would hope to see is some correlation, but by no means does the financial results guide the results of the rates. If you develop rates and it's not supported or substantiated by the financial actual expenditures or results, then I think you need to go back and you have to ask yourself, well, what am I missing? But in this case, your example actually shows good correlation. So the hopefully that addresses your question.
Okay.
That it's not directly used in the actuarial sound process, but certainly once we provide the rates to the state, it's certainly reviewed.
Okay, and I'm just thinking of Care Oregon, and who's a part of HealthShare, and the way maybe they distribute their profits, whereas Family Care doesn't have that model, and therefore their numbers are right there for you to see.
Senator Manas-Anderson and members of the committee, there are different business models. The CCOs certainly have a wide variety of business practices, and that's part of the reason that the rate setting process does not examine the financial or doesn't use the margin or profitability when computing rates. But to Zach's point, we did look, we do want to make sure, I mean, here's would be an extreme example, but we want to make sure that, let's say for the non-ACA population, we were going to make a big decrease. And then if you saw that that CCO already was not operating, you know, in the black, then to Zach's point, we'd have to go back to the actuaries and say, "This, there's something wrong with your model because it's not going to be sustainable." So we did have, once the rates were, rate ranges were developed, then we, the state, the Oregon Health Authority, selects the percentile where we, where the point in the rate range where for the payment, and once we modeled where to select that and to make sure that, and then worked with Mark's team to look at the financials.
It's just that when we're talking about profitability, which I really hate to do in the healthcare system, because when I have a Hep C patient email me and say, "Look at the profits," and I'm not able to have my health care taken care of, you know, that's another issue. But yeah, go ahead, proceed.
Sure. So we've walked you through some of the process and the thinking behind using risk score and splitting the process into the ACA versus the non-ACA. This slide is a very important slide because it gives you a glimpse at what actually occurred in an observation. So I made the comment earlier when I first started the presentation that some of the key observations were a bit, I think, surprising, and this is one of them. So by taking a step back and evaluating the true risk of this program as opposed to developing rates with a predetermined outcome with sustainable growth in mind, what we actually noticed was there's a significant shift between the expansion and the non-expansion rates. Now, that's going to go back to Lori's initial comments surrounding the methodologies that were in place prior to 2014, the cost template methodology. But, you know, the takeaway here is that when we evaluated the risk, the non-ACA actually, and it's showing up on the screen, had an increase of 12.8%, far exceeding the idea of sustainable growth. So you got to ask yourself, what's driving that? Well, there's a couple things driving that. One of them is accelerated trends due to pharmacy. Pharmacy trends are sky high all over the country in all programs, Medicaid included. But more importantly, there was a subsidization going on within the program where funds and expenditures were being transferred over into the ACA because this whole idea of sustainable growth and measuring it was only being applied to the non-ACA, and that I think had some non-intended consequences in the previous methodology and the templates that were being used. Now that we've evaluated the true risk and went through a level setting process, yes, we have a significant decrease in ACA. We've already showed you a slide that shows you why. What we didn't cover is that the 12.8% increase for your traditional populations, such as your TANF, your children populations, had significant increases. Now, what you would hope, and when I opened up my comments, is that actuarial soundness, being the backbone of this methodology, should put the program in a spot where it actually promotes and allows the success of sustainability. And we, one of the reasons we're in town is to present rates for Thursday and Friday for the 2016 time period. And while the 2015 there was a lot of fluctuation, not only between the ACA and the non-ACA, but also between CCOs because of the allocation due to risk. What we see in 2016 is exactly what we were hoping would happen, that once you go through the level set and you allocate that risk appropriately, that you then get that predictable growth, sustainable growth. And I think members of the committee will find that the rates that we will be discussed later in the week promote the whole idea of predictable growth. I mean, you don't have these large fluctuations. It was more of just level setting.
I still get nervous about having a base rate in a short of time. If there is fluctuation next year, it's not going to make any difference because you're using a base that may not be a true base.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's a good concern, but I'll go back to my comment that while the base is, I would say, in its infancy, it hasn't matured, it is better than having no base. And I think that is really what's on the table here, is you're comparing rates here that were set with no data, and then the rates that were set in this last two cycles were set with emerging data. And while not ideal, that is the most recent data that is available. If as we're measuring emerging experience in 2014, do I expect that expansion rate to move? Yes. Which direction? It's hard to say, but I would anticipate that rate will come down because, again, this population is a healthy population, and we've, even with the rates that we've proposed that are really behind the large decreases for some of the plans, has a lot of conservatism built in, which you can see from the slide that we showed. So, yes, there certainly will be some movement and expansion, but not as much movement as you've seen in the 2015 because that rate was set just way too high because no one knew much about the expansion at all.
So I go back. I was a part of this transformation process way from the beginning, and we wanted the CCOs to focus on health outcomes. And outcomes, I'm not sure how that's a part of the rate setting.
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, we have a couple mechanisms for assessing outcomes. So you will recall that we have a quality pool, and the CCOs are paid incentives for meeting quality pool metrics. There's 17 right now, and that is 4% of their total expenditures. Additionally, we know that this year is hard. We know that it involves a level setting. And as Zach said, when we take a look at the draft rates that will be the final rates will be presenting rate ranges to the CCOs on Thursday, Friday, we see that we've hit a spot where we can have a more predictable, sustainable rate of growth, and we don't expect these big swings. However, it's a first step, and we have engaged some Manat consulting firm and Optimus to work on some of the topics that you just mentioned. So rewarding alternative payments, looking at how we reward for value and quality. And that will be the work once we have the 2016 rates done between now and April, and we will be submitting a waiver amendment that will outline that in more detail. So we aren't finished with this methodology, but we plan to add moving forward, more ability to assess outcomes and other pieces.
Okay, Senator Knope, you had a question, and then Senator Shields.
I actually do. So in the ORS 411, 413, 414, there's a bunch of definitions. One of them talks about the global budget. And it says that the global budget means a total amount established prospectively by the Oregon Health Authority to be paid to coordinated care organizations for the delivery of, management of, and access to, and quality of health care delivered to members of a coordinated care organization. So was that taken into account as somebody made the decision to retroactively apply these rates?
Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, yes. The global budget is basically a per member per month payment that accomplishes those things that you outlined in that ORS. So it's not paid. We don't pay an annual sum, but a per member per month payment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you all had to say what the top three determinants of risk separating the typical health share client from the typical family care client, what would those three be? What's the driver in the difference between the populations? Setting aside, of course, the ACA expansion, because they're not even part of that risk pool, just the rest.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the overall driver of the difference in risk is the fact that family care has not as many members with chronic illnesses as health share. That comes out of the results of the risk score tool. As my earlier comments, the risk score tool is ran on a member level. And so it actually tracks the members and assigns them to a particular chronic ailment and then weights it and puts some math behind it. But if you were to look at the details behind the risk scores and behind the 0.94 and a 1.05, what you would see is that there's a disproportionate share of members with those chronic ailments in health share than in family care.
Final question. Could it be that family care is helping people move through those ailments and actually is doing a better job?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, certainly you would hope that there's some that is true. That's the purpose of health care. But I'll go back to my example of rheumatoid arthritis. Once you have a chronic illness, you always have the chronic illness. It's not like having pneumonia and you hope that you get over it. All you can do is really control the symptoms and improve your lifestyle going forward by efficient treatment. So can you move through some of those chronic ailments? You cannot. The purpose of the risk tool is to identify truly chronic illnesses. And that, I think that gets to Lori's statement in future rate cycles. We will be looking into how the various treatment patterns and are going on for someone with RA in health share versus RA in family care.
And then the final question, Madam Chair. So is that determined when they come onto the plan, or is it, can they be determined to be chronic after they've been a health share patient for 2 years or 6 months or one month? Or is it just when they begin?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the risk score tool is ran based on the eligibility of each of the plans for the base year in question. So the risk scores that we have been sharing with the committee during this presentation were based on the 2014 time period. So when did the member receive that diagnosis? Some of them probably received it while they were enrolled. Others have probably had it for years, and whether they received it before they became Medicaid eligible or when they were enrolled in another plan is it's probably a little of all of the above.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Hopefully you'll stay around in case there are questions. We have several representatives from CCOs that I want to make sure have a chance to talk for about not more than 10 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. Let's start with Jeff Hetherington and Tim Freeman. Welcome back.
Thank you. Are you ready for me?
I'm ready for you.
Great. Thank you for having me. I sure appreciate being here. For the record, my name's Tim Freeman. I'm a recovering state legislator and a Douglas County commissioner. I'm here today on the panel with the CCOs. I am on the board of our local CCO in Douglas County, but I'm also...
Is that all care?
Our CCO is Umpqua Health
Umpqua,
Alliance.
That's right.
And but I'm also on the board of a group of nonprofits that do this work around serving the same group of people. So I want you to know that I know I'm here representing the CCO, but I'm also on the Community Cancer Center nonprofit board. I'm on the Community Action Network board of directors. I also serve on the Community Health Alliance, which is the mental health nonprofit in our area. I serve on the Douglas County Public Health Network, which is a new nonprofit for public health services in Douglas County. I, of course, serve on the state's Early Learning Council, and I chair the local Early Childhood Development Council for the hub in our area. So I have lots of hats to wear, and the reason I bring that up is because all of these groups work together. And so when you talk about you're going to look at doing rates different for any one of those groups, it affects all of them. And I think it's important to realize that. It's easy for the folks that sat here before us to look at numbers, and they look at numbers in their box. They don't look at numbers outside of what is encounter data. So the encounter data is very important, and I appreciate that work. But the fact is the CCOs have been asked to be much more involved than just the specific delivering of health care, and our community certainly do that. So I wanted to make sure and bring that up. I wanted to talk just briefly about the experience that we all had. I know Senator Knopes knew. He wasn't there when we did that, but he was certainly there for the tail end of it. But we sat down in 2009, 2010, and specifically in 2011, we started the transformation of healthcare in a meaningful way. You and I served as co-chairs along with Representative Greenlich on the special committee on joint committee on healthcare transformation, and we did that work. And one of the major reasons we came together to do that was this whole discussion you just had around actuarial sound. This actuarial sound numbers and talk about numbers is what led us for 20 years in the Oregon healthcare plan, and it led us to a point where we were $247 million short in the budget, so we had to transform healthcare. We looked at all this stuff. It seemed like, I mean, it was just like a deja vu sitting here, you know, from almost 6 years ago hearing all this stuff, when in fact we recognized in the work that we did that we had to look at more than just the healthcare cost that is affected by these CCOs and these services. We sat together, you and I and others, when we started the transformation of healthcare, and we had multiple stakeholders come to the table. And when we started, virtually every stakeholder group was against the idea of transforming healthcare. They all opposed it. They had all carved out their little niche and said, leave it alone, don't mess with it. And again, we sat in front of them and convinced them and had meetings and discussed and took input and decided there was a better way. There was a way of looking at the entire picture of cost and the way that providing care would make sure that we were looking at downstream costs and other costs associated with the state and things we had to do. And we came up with this coordinated care model concept. And we negotiated with them the idea that if they found ways to cut cost to provide better outcomes, that they wouldn't be punished for it, that we wouldn't take the money away. And it looks to me like it's pretty interesting. The last presentation they started with, we have 16 CCOs and they're all doing well. That might should have been the end of the conversation. Many of us were wondering if any of them were going to do well when we started. The fact that 16 of them are up and going and all running and operating in the black, we should stop for a minute and sort of celebrate that, because we were very fearful that wasn't going to happen. Then we go on to say, well, 10 of them, we're going to have to cut the rates a little bit. Six of them, we're going to give more money. Another way of saying that is 10 of them did exactly what we asked them to do. We asked them to go out and find innovative ways to be collaborative in their community, to find ways to lower cost, to create healthier populations, and if you did that, we wouldn't punish you. And here we are today talking about rates again in just a very few short years. So I'm sad to hear that. I think that we are really going against the principles and the agreement and the negotiated position we had when we did this work. I'll remind everybody, after all those months of meetings, after all those hours of listening to testimony, after all those thousands of pages of input that we received, and after we negotiated agreement with providers and provider groups around this state, and after they signed a floor letter supporting and agreeing to enter this grand experiment with us, And we passed these bills across the floor with large bipartisan majorities, we're back here today not only talking about going back to the old model that caused us to have to do this work, but going back to the old model retroactively to last January. I can't even imagine how further from the promise we made we could get than we are here today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for coming up, too.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president and CEO of Family Care. For the history, Family Care is a 31-year-old Medicaid managed care company. We're the oldest one now in the state, and I'm pleased to say I've been in charge of family care ever since the day it started. That doesn't mean I'm the oldest one in the state, however. I'd like to address a few things right up front, and it does not necessarily get us off to a happy start. First of all, I want to talk about a couple things that were represented here in testimony by the OHA. Number one, they talk about the fact that this is a transparent process and a collaborative process. I will tell you that none of that is true for Family Care's experience. We have asked and asked and asked for multiple types of information. We have gotten none of it. In response to Senator Shields' question about were the Freedom of Information Act requests granted, the answer is no, they were not. We have not received any emails that we asked for. We have not received any other information that we have asked for. And in fact, we have a letter here that's in your packet that says that the OHA considers this information requested is a trade secret of the Oregon Health Authority. Now, I don't know how you can get there and then say you have had transparency, but you have not. We asked for multiple types of information. One of the things that was most interesting that some members of the legislature were told was, well, we only denied them three columns of information. This is representative of about 30 some odd pages. I didn't count. But this is what was denied us in terms of information. And every page is a new number of columns. By the time you get page four, you have 49 columns, most of them blacked out. So when they say they were transparent and they let us know what happened, that is not accurate. We haven't seen the information. We don't know how the information was arrived at, and we don't know what kind of adjustments they made during that process. The next thing you were told was that CMS made them redo the rates. We filed a demand for admission with the Oregon Health Authority. And that is a legal term that requires them to admit or deny certain questions. One of the questions was, did CMS require you to make these rates retroactive, and did CMS require you to redo the rates? To date, they have not answered that question. So for them to get up here and say that it did nothing, we've seen, we'll show you what the chair asked for. In other words, do you have that in writing? I think you should keep asking for that, because I don't think it exists. At least we have not seen it to date, and we've been asking for this information for a long time. With regard to actuarial soundness, the one thing you did not hear in this entire discussion was that the rates for the individual CCOs were actuarially sound. They were not. The actuarial opinion clearly states that the regional rates are actuarially sound, and then clearly states that the rates for individual CCOs are not part of that certification. So they didn't certify individual CCO rates, and this is the first time in 30 years that they have not certified individual CCO rates, and our contract requires that they do so. And what bothers me about the testimony that in this three hearings to date is the truths that have been told only halfway, that literally give you a wrong impression of what's really going on, because we have not all signed off on this. We are not all happy with this. Even the people that got the raises will in some cases tell you they don't think that this was a good process. Now, the last thing that I'd like to talk about, and hopefully don't go over my time, is the question that was asked is, does profitability come into this rate-setting process? I would assert that it has, because of the way that they carefully worded each of their answers, that they use the cost templates that the plans turn in. Those cost templates do not separate profitability out from expenses. In other words, when most of the plans who have related entities submit their cost templates, profitability that's passed on to sub-organizations is listed as an expense and counted as an expense. So when you see the difference between Family Care's expense, as you did up on that slide, versus, say, HealthShare's, HealthShare has a capitated model for their related entities. Nothing wrong with that, and this is not a criticism of HealthShare, because it's a perfectly legitimate business plan. But they pass profitability through onto their sub-capitated entities. The OHA has not counted those. And you can tell that by the graph that you see, because the graph that you see on net margin shows that Family Care had a whopping net margin. We had $73 million in net profits. And that shows up on the cost reports that we turn in. The cost report that's turned in by HealthShare shows that they had $14.5 million in net profits. And that's accurate. The problem with that is if you look at the, I hope I have that here. Maybe I don't. There's a sheet right at the top. It shows a number of figures with the CCOs across the top, highlighted in yellow. That one that Senator Cruz has. If you look at that, it will show clearly down at the bottom, Family Care had $73 million in net profits, and HealthShare had 14.5. What doesn't show in the OHA reports, but does show clearly in the audited financials of some of their subcontractors, is that Care Oregon had a net profit that's listed under the Tri-County area of some $76 million. Now, if you add those two together, you get $91 million. What's not shown, because the other audited reports are not as clear as Care Oregon's, is what's the net profitability under Medicaid for Providence, Tualatin, Kaiser, and the three mental health county operations.
And Legacy.
So that's not in there, and there's no way for me to guess what they might be. But that's not counted in their rate-setting process. And they were very clear about that. They told you that their rate-setting process included basically their direct service costs, their sub-capitated costs, and their incentives. They left out, again, they left out profits because they didn't consider that. You know, but I will tell you one thing, and I'll close with this. Every time we went to talk to them about what they were doing with the rates, both the January rates and these, the first thing out of the bureaucrats' mouths was, well, you guys made a lot of money this year. Now, someone says it once to me, I'll write it off. But when they say it six or seven times over and over again, I think somehow it's playing into their methodology. Now, that's just my belief, but I think they included it. I firmly believe that $55 million is nothing more than a clawback. You know, there's all sorts of things wrong with, in my opinion, what they did with these rates. But the biggest thing that's wrong with it, I'll go back to what former recovering Representative Trim Freeman said, and that is, you know, this was a global budget, and it was a five-year contract. It never was expected that we would spend all of our money within a budget year and then move to zero and do it again in the next year. We have distributed over $5 million of our profitability in the year 2015, and we have more to distribute. We understood that's the way it was supposed to work. was that this was an ongoing operation. We didn't know that it was a year-to-year. And we think that the OHA is wrong in their methodology, they're wrong in their policy. And the question that Senator Canope asked, which was not answered, we believe the law is very clear that the rates are supposed to be set on a prospective basis, that they have no right to set them retroactively. You know, this is a whole departure from what was intended for the CCO program. Thank you.
First, I'd like to say that former Representative Freeman's not actually recovering. He's a county commissioner now.
We're like zombies. It's hard to get out.
You know, Jeff, you're talking about proprietary information, which I understand in private sector businesses. How does a public entity have proprietary information?
Beats me. There were some CCOs that said they were concerned about individually identifying providers, and that is not what we asked for. And we understand that that is really a trade secret of the individual CCO. But we were asking for more global numbers, nothing that was individually identifiable, either by patient or by contract.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator.
Chair.
Senator Canope.
Yes, thank you. Commissioner Freeman, first of all, he indicated that I was new. I'm actually recycled.
That's right.
I did miss that period where you guys had some votes on some of this stuff. But can you give me an example of a risk adjustment and what we're talking about? Because I am the layperson up here. So,
thank you, Vice Chair Senator Cruz and Senator Canope. And thank you for asking me that. And the example that we all heard 100 times was the air conditioner. Well, air conditioner and a window, right? We all heard that. Let me use a different one that really sort of got me in this line of thinking, because much like you, I'm not a healthcare provider. I own a gas station. So I am not at all in the same place a lot of the people are on this. So the example that I heard from one of then managed care organizations is they had a situation in their managed care organization where over time they had gotten to where they had a lot of babies being born prematurely addicted to drugs from mothers that were addicted to drugs. And they were above the average and really going the wrong direction on that. And of course, that brings in a lot of dollars, a premature baby born and with all the issues associated with the healthcare cost is very expensive. But downstreams, it's also very expensive. You have all the cost of what can be very high needs children throughout a lifetime. So very expensive situation for the state, for the taxpayers of the state. So this particular MCO identified that and said, you know, we're gonna try something. And what they did is they figured out that what they wanted to try, knowing they wouldn't get paid for it, but they wanted to try this, and they found recovering addicted women in their community, and they hired them. They bought them cars and they sent them out to the community to find these women that were pregnant and becoming pregnant, that were addicted to drugs. And they brought them in for a variety of levels of treatment, connected them with housing, found ways to treat them with their addiction through their health care, prenatal. And they found that they were able to move that dial. Babies were being born more to term, healthier, and not addicted to drugs. And that was a very good thing. So guess what happened the next year when they did the risk adjustment? Oh. They don't have that need anymore, so they took the money away. That's the exact example that I remember of what we do not want to do. That's the problem with actuarial soundness. That's the problem with risk adjustment. It moves the whole entire idea of incentives and innovation away from the direction that's the cost savings for the total system, and it moves it to just the encounter data. And I think that is a huge mistake, and that's what I'm fearful of this. And I heard the presentation. I know there's a few extra things in there, but I'm really fearful of moving back to that.
Yeah, follow up.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you humanizing it, because sometimes we tend to get stuck on numbers in the legislature and don't look to the lives behind those numbers and see that. So either one of you or both of you, so you obviously have indicated that there's a problem. It sounds like there's several more people behind you that will indicate the same thing. So from a legislative perspective, what would you like to see the outcome be, and how can the legislature play a part in helping achieve that?
I have a short answer, then you can go. Give it time. Excuse me. Senator Cruz, give it time. Let the process work for a while. This was an experiment or an attempt or an agreement over a period of time. One thing that we didn't talk about, and I haven't heard yet, maybe some people will talk about it, we have this very small amount of data from a few months of the expanded populations. In rural Oregon, we haven't been able to hire the providers to spend the money on yet. So it's we haven't had enough time to really see what's going on. So my advice is slow down. We did a huge amount of change in a very quick period of time. Let it play out for a little while. Give it a little bit of time to sort of the dust to settle and see where it lands.
Senator Cruz and Senator Knope, members of the committee, having been in front of this body for way too many years, I would say that, you know, my first bit of advice is listen carefully. Just because you hear a lot of talk and a lot of numbers and a lot of explanations does not mean you're getting an answer. I think a lot of that has happened in the last 2 days. The other thing is in addition to getting the answer that you want, which is important, I think the other thing is to clearly lay down to the agency what the policy issues are that you want them to follow. One of them is the global budget with a prospective rate. You know, everything you heard today is exactly the 180% different direction from what the legislature said they wanted. And I think, you know, I know you only come into session every year, but maybe you have to say it again. And then the other thing I'd say, if you don't see you getting what you want, then you have to go to the head of the executive department and say, why aren't your agencies behaving the way we put down in law?
Anything else? It is interesting, because one of the things we were supposed to do is get away from counting beans. Pure and simple, and it seems like we still get stuck back to counting things, and to a degree, I know that's impossible not to count some things. But anyway,
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I don't really know, and this is sort of a general comment rather than specifically for Commissioner Freeman or Mr. Hetherington. I completely appreciate the concerns that are being raised. That being said, I think it is important to remember that it was not the health authority's decision to revamp the rates. That was at the direction of CMS. It's unclear about whether CMS is pushing to do this retroactively or not. We need a little bit more clarity around that. But it's not as if the health authority set the rates knowing that they were going to have to turn around and set them lower again. I agree that this is not playing out in ways that are easy for some of the CCOs. There's no question about that. I think your point about counting beans is real, but the slides that we saw from Mr. Adders and others suggest that they are looking at more than just beans. They're looking at more than just the fee-for-service component, and they are taking into account a range of services that the CCOs are providing in their communities, not just the ones that are traditional. Mr. Hetherington, you seem like you really don't agree with anything I'm saying.
Well, I wouldn't make it personal, Senator Cruz and Senator Steiner-Hayward, but I think the information that you've been given is inaccurate, and that's okay. What I would say.
Then, Senator Cruz, I've had the privilege of hearing presentation on this twice in the past 2 days, because I also serve on the Human Services Subcommittee, and we had a presentation on this issue yesterday. And I don't wish to belabor any points, but I'm very concerned about the ongoing disagreement between what materials have been provided and the methodology. And I don't really know how to approach that, Senator. And colleagues, I'd be interested in your thoughts, because we have the health authority, several people getting up here and saying, here's what we did, here's how we did it, here are the numbers, here's the information we provided people, here's how we engaged people. And we've got Mr. Hetherington sitting here saying none of that is accurate. And I don't know how to handle that. And I'd really appreciate guidance from any of you to think about that question.
I agreed. I mean, I asked to sit in the dais and listen to testimony, and I agreed with the chair that I would not speak. That was sort of the deal.
But she's not here, so go ahead.
But I'm on this committee. So. She may be watching.
We're still there.
That was close.
Yeah, I know. But I gave you permission, so you're okay.
I think this is one of those things where there's truth on both sides. And there's half-truths on both sides, too. I think that from what I've been able to uncover in the last 3 or 4 weeks, that there is money in other systems and CCLs that is not being counted, and Optimus didn't have access to that and couldn't include it in their rates. I've got numbers now for the first quarter of this year that I just received, and if they're correct, I haven't had a chance to look at them. The rate, the encounter data and cost for family care and health care is almost exactly the same for the first quarter. So why is one getting cuts and one getting more pay? I think there's also a situation here where the amount of money being paid for the expanded population may have been higher than it should have been, but we don't know yet because that's just ramping up. And the basic principle we have with the CCOs has been violated. The basic principle is we have a global budget that's prospective. Is a five-year program, and any savings that occur either by actions of the CCOs or quotation marks questionable overpayment by somebody gets plowed back into the system and used to get more future savings as we attack the real issues here, which are people with multiple social issues. Now they're the ones driving the cost. We're now looking at 5% of the population driving a huge part of the cost. Some people say up to 50%. That 5% have a lot of emotional, drug and alcohol, poverty issues, housing issues, and the idea is to attack that to the CCOs. We can't do that if the money's being pulled back out. So that's my biggest concern here. We can argue forever about who gets what, but when we start pulling that kind of money out, and I assume since it's federal money, it's not going back in the system, it's going back to the federal government, I would assume. I may be wrong on that assumption, but we need to keep that money in the state. I mean, but we also need to hold the CCOs accountable for reinvesting that money in their communities in an effective fashion. I don't expect them to do that in 12 months, but over a period of 2 or 3 years, I want to see a lot of housing built in Portland. I don't want to be stepping over people in the street anymore in Portland. I mean, I come up here and visit. I'm shocked by the way the city looks. And CCOs are designed to help deal with those issues. So I'll stop there. My biggest concern here is the basic principles of the CCOs have been violated, and that's my biggest concern.
In just a minute, I'll turn the gavel.
I'm sorry, I got permission to speak.
Oh no, I think it's
fine. And in response to Senator Hayward's question as to what we do next, I would suggest, because we have a chair of policy committee and a co-chair of a budget committee dealing with this issue, that in the next few weeks, we get a group together that doesn't violate quorum issues, and we figure out what it is we want to hear during next legislative days. Senator Bates, you think that's an appropriate approach?
And we may have to set a plan. We're running out of time.
Yeah, I know.
It's a real problem. And so we're going to have to make some tough decisions, right. And hopefully we can work with the agency and come up with something that will work for all parties in a reasonable fashion. And CMS, our other partners who are in the room right now.
Okay, you can have control back, Madam Chair.
Okay, I think we'll move to the next panel.
Thank you.
Deb, is it Bergren, Dave Nyman, and Sean Jetta? Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Please, somebody start.
Someone start. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I'll go first. Just give me 1 second to boot. There we are.
supposed to be Mimi Haley from Columbia Pacific.
Next. There's another panel.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Neiman. I'm a fellow of the Society of Actuaries and a member of the American Academy of Actuaries. Currently, I serve as a senior consulting actuary for Wakely Consulting Group. The Oregon Health Authority invited me here today to discuss my experience as a consulting actuary supporting CCOs through the 2015 rate development process. Please note that I have participated and witnessed the rate-setting process since the inception of CCOs, so I was there in September 2012 when the initial global budgets were set. It's important to note that the opinions expressed are those of the speaker, do not represent those of the Society of Actuaries, American Academy of Actuaries, nor the Actuarial Standard Boards, nor Wakely Consulting Group, nor any Oregon CCO. These are my opinions. In addition to participate in the Oregon rate-setting process, I have excess of 10 years of Medicaid rate-setting experience, worked in Minnesota, Iowa, Michigan, witnessed what's unfolding in Illinois. So I have a broad sense of, you know, experience across the country. I'm also an active participant on the Society of Actuaries Medicaid Work Group, which has included various speaking engagements and publications. So in my experience, you know, through the past 10 years of Medicaid rate setting, those most effective are supported by a clear understanding of the data used and the methodology applied. Two critical components to achieve this success are communication and collaboration. The 2015 process implemented, including the weekly checkpoints, which were attended by all of my actuarial counterparts within all of the various CCOs, met my expectations on both fronts. Never in a rate-setting process previous have I had the opportunity to engage in the consulting actuaries and the, you know, the department staff more than once or twice. I was given an opportunity weekly in a public forum as well as multiple meetings in a private forum. Hiring the external actuaries to support the process resulted in significant improvements relative to the initial September 2012 rate-setting process. I clearly understood the underlying base data and its applicability, the projection factors, and the models utilized to develop rates. This is the first time in my actuarial career that an Excel-based model to set rates was provided to me. This is the ultimate, you know, gives me the ultimate comfort in the process that took place. Also, again, at each step in the process and on weekly forums, I was able to solicit feedbacks. At no time did I feel my feedback was not given thought and consideration. Of course, we're not always going to agree, the state entities and the CCO, on the final decision. However, the decisions made throughout the process never lack support via data or reasoning. I participated in many state engagements in which my feedback was blown off. It didn't happen throughout this process. From an actuarial perspective, the process implemented followed generally accepted practices and principles. The following are some examples. First, I think it's important to understand that the rates were rebased. The prior global budget that we've been pushing forward was based on 2012 capitation rates, which was based on 2010 experience. A rebase or a reset, I mean, Medicaid populations have high churn. They change rapidly. However, this never occurred until this 2015 rate development process. And the outcome of doing this is updating the underlying data for improved alignment of program-specific risks and capitation rates. The benefits include, as mentioned previously, there's a proper allocation of rates within an area and rates between eligibility categories. There's also a redistribution of funds between the ACA and non-ACA, which was shown. An important detail that has been left out of every presentation to date is this mitigates the risk of minimum loss ratio or medical loss ratio payment. So if you recall, to the extent that a medical loss ratio for the ACA was less than 80%, there was going to be checks cut back to CMS. So I think what would have been helpful through this process is to see what's the rate change, what's the effective rate change, because the starting point or the rates of the ACA starting point weren't adjusted to reflect the likelihood of payment. And in doing this, it keeps money in the system. By shifting from the ACA to the non-ACA, more money stayed within the system. The base data used were appropriate. Most recent data sources were utilized. All expense data were incorporated, including those related to alternative payment methodologies. Spent countless hours on the phone
communicating the various payment methodologies underlying CCOs with whom I work, and getting the proper allocation of those expenses, those that happen outside of the adjudication process. Medical expenses were reconciled to medical expenses from related entity financial statements. Again, countless hours for us through the reconciliation process to adjust financial exhibits to reflect the true underlying expenses at the entity level and not the subcapitation arrangement reflected in such organization. The risk adjustment process is consistent with the other states in which I work. It's an improvement in the rate-setting process relative to prior years as it recognizes population morbidity differences within a region. There was also careful consideration given to the appropriateness of risk adjustment factors for each eligibility category. It's been previously mentioned that the ACA, for the ACA groups, the experience didn't have an appropriate duration for risk adjustment and cost-based relativity was applied. However, for certain eligibility categories like newborns, risk adjustment isn't implied in the rate setting process, given the inability of organizations or health systems have the likelihood of at-risk newborns. So that specifically that rate category is not risk adjusted. And OHA committed to monitoring results to identify improvement opportunities, which I think is important. It's not just a one-time deal. So in my opinion, the process was fair. All data and methods were publicly discussed, and the conclusions reached were supported and clearly communicated. So far, the focus of my presentation has been on the state rate setting process. It's critical to not forget our federal partner, CMS. It is clear through CMS guidance and actions, there's an enhanced emphasis on the Medicaid rate setting process and its oversight. The changes discussed today align with new expectations, and it is reasonable to assume that the changes implemented will be well received by CMS now and into the future rate setting development periods. A process that allows for efficient review by CMS significantly reduces the administrative burden on the program. Thank you for the opportunity for me to share my experiences working through the 2015 rate development process.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Deb Bergen, and I am the rates manager for Care Oregon, serving three coordinated care organizations, Yamhill, Columbia Pacific, and Jackson Care Connect. I'm here today to discuss our experience with the rate development process. Again, thank you for the opportunity to meet with this committee. I would like to share my experience with just how the process unfolded. As the rate manager for Care Oregon, I'm proud to provide rate setting assistance to three community-based CCOs. Yamhill CCO is located in McMinnville and predominantly services 22,000 members in Yamhill County. Jackson Care Connect is located in Medford and numbers 29,000 members. Columbia Pacific, I'll defer and let Mimi Haley tell you more about that. But I would like to point out that it's located on the coast and serves members living in Clatsop, Columbia, and Tillamook counties. So I help CCOs across the diverse spectrum. Overall, I found the process to improve the rate methodology to be both transparent and fair. The new revised rate methodology, I believe, will better ensure that the state of Oregon can consistently and accurately develop actuarially sound rates in a predictable and timely fashion. It's important that for the CCOs that I serve that there is a rate development process in place that will consistently and predictably produce rates that will be efficiently approved by CMS. It's very important. In June 2015, CMS released draft guidance that clearly sends the message that the CMS approval process will be driven by actuarial principles, processes, and documentation. They are our partners. Fortunately, I do see this as a positive development, requiring all managed Medicaid care entities to use data-driven approaches to develop fair, transparent, and financially sustainable rates. The new rate methodology process will better position both the state of Oregon and CCOs to meet CMS's rate setting expectations. In general, I believe that this new rate methodology was well designed and will prove to be sustainable, reliable, and a valuable tool for current and future rate setting. During the last 6 months, as the new improved rate methodology was being developed, both OHA and Optimist demonstrated very strong leadership over the improvement process. Affecting major change across multiple organizations can be a daunting task. But overall, the revision process was extremely well organized and effectively and efficiently implemented. I appreciated the opportunities for consistent and complete communication with both OHA and Optimus. Early on in the revision process, the state proved to be a very collaborative partner, acknowledging and responding to CCO needs, questions, and concerns. One example was the state establishing not only a monthly rate work group, but also choosing to implement a weekly actuary meeting to discuss assumptions and solve for answers to technical issues. Providing that weekly forum for communication between all stakeholders was invaluable. That critical step helped to make the process more organized, collaborative, and transparent. Ideas were shared, problems were solved, but most importantly, OHA and Optimist took great effort to keep CCOs abreast on how the rate revision process was being evolved into a sustainable model. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Jessup, and I'm the Director of Medicaid Programs at Moda Health and the Eastern Oregon CCO. And I'm here today to talk about our experience with the rate-setting process. So I'll start off by saying that having in-house actuaries within our CCO was a key factor in understanding the details, approach, and assumptions used by Optimus throughout the rate redevelopment process. Additionally, having in-house actuaries that understand our organization, our finances, the nuances of our utilization data, and the unique features of our CCO, such as our alternate payment methodology, how we allocate for costs that are not in the encounter data, and our rural geography, were all essential components to our interaction with Optimus and OHA. And I would say being able to speak actuary to actuary was key. Overall, we felt there was adequate transparency throughout the process. We understood the approach and models and assumptions that were being used. Both OHA and Optimus staff were available to us when needed to answer questions. And additionally, there was regular communication about how CMS and the Office of Actuary were responding to the approach and assumptions Optimus was using or planning to use. As a reminder for the committee, EOCCO operates in 12 rural and frontier counties in Eastern Oregon. We serve nearly 50,000 members across 50,000 square miles, and our members have limited access to care and services. And because we are a rural-only CCO, there are some unique funding issues that must be addressed as part of any rate development process. For example, there are 10 rural hospitals operating within our 12-county geography. 7 of the 10 are Type A critical access hospitals, and 5 of the 10 are part of health districts. As part of the rate-setting process, we had to ensure that we continued to receive adequate funding to reimburse our rural hospitals at their cost of providing care to Medicaid members, so that they can continue to provide and expand upon the services available within their local communities. And Optimus did account for our prevalence of Type A critical access hospital utilization within our CCO and adjusted our rate accordingly. Another unique feature of our CCO is the fact that we have no tertiary hospitals within our 12-county geography. And this feature is significant because not all high-level hospital care, such as trauma care, complicated deliveries, and neonatal care, are provided at larger tertiary centers. And for us, those tertiary centers are primarily located out of state in Boise, Idaho, and the Tri-Cities in Washington State in Central Oregon or in Portland. Now, during the review of the proposed methodology to pay CCOs for newborn deliveries, we noted through the initial methodology that out-of-state hospital costs were not going to be included in the methodology. Well, this was a huge concern for us, as the majority of our high-cost deliveries are performed out of state. And when we provided this feedback to Optimus about this issue, they modified the methodology to include the out-of-state hospital costs for all the CCOs. And then I'd say that, you know, finally throughout the rate redevelopment process, we were able to submit data and reports substantiating our 2015 emerging experience, which would not have been available in the initial 2015 rate setting. This was particularly important for us as we began to see higher costs and trends for the ACA population, as they began to use higher levels of service in 2015. And additionally, we were able to provide emergent experience in our increased utilization of high-cost specialty medications, specifically around paying for more Hep C medications. So in closing, we felt that OHA and Optimus took into consideration the unique needs and features of operating within a rural geography as rates were developed, and while this process has and continues to be a tremendous amount of work for our staff, we were satisfied with the overall process. And our hope moving forward is that we will not now see an overcorrection to this level setting of the rates, and that we will begin to see future years and build towards the sustainable rate of growth that's in line with the global budget. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for coming. Thank you. All right. Questions? All right. Mimi Haley and Tayo Atkins. And I believe that's it for this segment. We're almost on schedule.
You're on schedule?
Extremely modern.
There isn't anyone else that was going to... Please proceed.
Great. Thank you very much, Chairwoman Montes Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mimi Haley. I'm the executive director of Columbia Pacific CCO, and I have served in that role since its inception in September of 2012. As Deb Bergman mentioned, Columbia Pacific CCO includes three rural counties in the northwest of Oregon. That's Columbia, Tillamook, and Clatsop counties. We serve approximately 25,000 members, and we've had a very interesting growth pattern. I would call it a stair-step growth pattern. We started with 7,000 members. Within 2 months, the state rolled over 5,500 fee-for-service open card patients onto our CCO, folks who had never experienced managed Medicaid before. And with the ACA, we grew by 80% to over 28,000 members by the end of 2014. And that was a stunning growth, given that we had no commensurate increase in the number of primary care, behavioral health, or dental providers in that service area. So I do want to address, as you heard, a lot of technical details about the rate-setting process. As an executive of a CCO, I can't actually understand a lot of those details, but I do understand there were several features of the process that were very important to me and to my CCO. I do believe that this new rate-setting process, while this is a bumpy year, will ultimately lead to better sustainability and more predictability in terms of the rates that we can expect to receive to care for the members that we have. Unlike some of the CCOs, in fact, maybe all of the CCOs, we saw an immediate increase in the utilization of the ACA population that enrolled with our CCO. We did not appear to have some of the laggardly behaviors, and in fact, we saw increases in utilization that were consistent with the population that we enrolled, which were largely older uninsured adults, so increases in imaging and a lot of outpatient surgical procedures. Our CCO is served primarily by 8 major clinics. Some of them are system clinics, Providence, Adventist, OHSU. Several of them are federally qualified health centers. All of our hospitals are critical access or AB hospitals, as you've heard referenced before. And all of our outpatient services are provided by those same AB hospitals. Some of our services, as Sean mentioned, are provided in the Portland area. All of the addiction services in our CCO require travel to Portland. So it was very important to us that the state and Optimus deployed several methodologies that really accounted for the unique characteristics of Columbia Pacific CCO. The first was to apply these emerging trends of the ACA experience to the base year data. That was very important, and we appreciated the fact that OHA took the additional time that they needed to take, some of which was unintended, but they did use that extra time to allow that emerging data to support the trends that we had seen early on. We were able to provide them with information that saw what we were seeing with our ACA population, which was different from the other CCOs, including those CCOs that Deb referenced that she supports on behalf of Care Oregon. The other significant change in this rate-setting methodology that we appreciated was the factoring of the AB hospitals in the rate-setting process. As I mentioned, we asked that the AB factors be applied to both outpatient hospital services as well as inpatient services, as the majority of our services are provided on an outpatient basis. And they did take that into account with the rate adjustment process for our CCO and the other CCOs that rely on critical access hospitals. And as you recall and know,
critical access hospitals are paid on a cost basis, not on a contracted rate basis. And so for our CCO, those services approximate 60% of our total medical spend, which is a significant amount of the dollars coming into our CCO, and therefore the adjustment was critical to our ability to be able to continue to provide services. The third thing that we appreciated was the underlying risk-adjusted, member-specific risk adjustment methodology that allowed the underlying risk of the CCO-specific population to be accounted for in the rate-setting process. And you've heard about that quite a bit from the prior presenters, but that has been a critical change in the rate-setting process to look at the risk of our population, which is different from the risk of other populations in the CCO. So that was an additional factor that was taken into account. And the fourth that represented the state and Optimus's willingness to listen to us was the issue of the rating regions. Columbia Pacific was originally put into the same rating region as the Portland metro area. And the delivery system and the population, I would argue, are significantly different. And so they did create a fourth rating region, which is the Northwest region. There are four CCOs in that region, of which we are one, and I believe that is much more reflective of a shared delivery system and care experience for the members that we serve. I will say that although profitability has been mentioned a couple of times and is not really a factor in the rate-setting process, I will say that Columbia Pacific has not been one of those CCOs that is sustainable without the financial backing of Care Oregon. Our margin in 2013 was about $100,000, and that's off of a revenue base of about $50 million. Our margin in 2014 was about $800,000, and I think you can all appreciate that that's insufficient for transformation. If we're really going to transform our health system in some of the ways that we all hope CCOs are able to do, that we need to have a sufficient margin to be able to do that. And several prior testimony indicated, and I believe it was Senator Bates who said that we should be plowing that money back into our communities, and that is exactly what we are doing with whatever it is we generate. So I do believe that going forward, we need to figure out how to reconcile the global budget with this new rate-setting methodology that CMS is requiring of the state of Oregon and of the CCOs within that. I think we can do that together. I'm fairly optimistic that we can find a way to do that. I do believe that there are some things that we all need to take into account, including the unsustainable trend with pharmacy costs. And I don't think that's news to anybody. It's not unique to Medicaid, and it's certainly not unique to this state. But it is something that will be a budget buster if we don't collectively address it. So I think that moving forward, we have an opportunity to set the rates in 2015. I think that we're going to hear more this week about our 2016 rates, and that gives us an opportunity then to move on and to move forward with figuring out some of these other things that allow alternative payment methodology and transformation and innovation to be part of the process of the setting of the rates. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tyre Akins, and I'm the CEO of Cascade Health Alliance. I'm here today to discuss my experience regarding
you
the rate.
Put your,
You don't have to be that close.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, let me start over. Good afternoon.
No, you're too close.
They're very sensitive. Oh. You can just talk normal.
All right. Good afternoon.
We heard you.
Chair Anderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tyre Akins, and I'm the CEO of Cascade Health Alliance based in Klamath Falls, Klamath County. I'm here today to discuss my experience regarding the rate redevelopment process. So I'm going to break down the process into three major buckets. Cascade Health Alliance is one of the smallest CCO, and we went into effect in September 2013. Mm-hmm. As a result of the ACA expansion, we attracted members who were actually more chronically ill. And as you probably know, Klamath County has one of the worst healthcare outcomes. So as we look through this rate setting, and I've been on the job for 7 months, so I'll describe this in buckets. So looking through, I'm going to describe it, one, previous previous rate setting, the current rate settings, and the impacts. So prior in 2015, as I got on board and talked to my interim, obviously my predecessors here, Bill Guest, but also talked to my prior interim CEO, the prior rate process was described as follows: lack of transparency, chaos and frustration, inconsistency regarding data, variation in rate settings, last minute deadline to sign a contract. So that was the prior process. This current process, which I was part of, was data-driven, was structured approach to rate setting, which has actuarial soundness. It was painfully transparent, and it was painfully collaborative. As part of you might know, I've been to other states. Oregon happens to be one of those application states. So you apply. If you meet the standards, you get the membership. If this was an RFP state where you procure the Medicare process, this would not be as transparent. So this process, from our perspective, was very transparent, was very structured around data. We can understand it. We talked to our actuary to understand the logic that drives everything behind it. And because we have one of the worst health outcomes, obviously the rate aligns with risk. We're taking on more risk. We have more emerging experience, and I know a lot of people have talked about emerging experience. It's basically we're taking on a lot more chronic care members. So we want to take care of our members and transform the delivery of care. And this rate-setting process aligns and rebases that in such a way that we're fairly compensated for the members that you and I are allowed to for our members. So having talked about the previous process and the current process, the impacts, these are the impacts. Greater state transparency, need for documentation, which we've talked about in terms of data. Each rate cell must be actuarially sound. And Optimus, they were really transparent. I've been, out of all the states that we've looked at RFP in terms of my prior life, this is as transparent as it could humanly possibly be. And obviously, in order to, as part of the waiver, this is a three-way partnership: CMS, OHA, and Oregon. So in order to reach sustainable growth rate, you need to baseline as part of the global budget. And obviously, as Zach indicated, all this has to be actuarially sound in order for him to certify it, and has to meet CMS requirement in order for it to be actuarially sound. And obviously, that benefits us. Thank you for allowing me to share my experience.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, I would love to call OHA back, but I won't, only because I think that, first of all, thank you, everyone who testified. It's extremely important to have this on board. We do have one more item on the agenda, but what I will want to work with OHA is regarding, I think, the rates. Lynn, do you want to come up? And the rates are going to be set October 6th. Is that what you said for the 2015? What I had heard is there is concern about the 2015 rates. You know, 2016, you're going to have those ready, and the 2016 will go. So that's the retroactivity in the 2015 rates that is a real issue for the losers, not for the winners, of course. They would love to have more money. And the third thing, okay, rates, retroactivity, and then the third thing was the request for public records. You know, one CCO said it was not provided, and you did say they were provided. So those are three things that I would like to talk with you, not here, okay, but you know, in the future, so that we can I have no idea if there are legislators that are going to want to have legislation or not, but I think that for me, and I'm sure there are members that might want to speak with you. So,
could I make one quick comment? I am concerned about what appears to be the lack of transparency in this document, and I think this document actually, I'm 90% sure, is incorrect. I was very familiar with the Karen Kirsch rate review case, and if you look at that great journalistic website, the Lund Report, going back to 2009, you'll notice that what my understanding is what the Department of Justice said is that for something to be withheld, it not just has to be a trade secret that might affect a competitor, but it has to be injurious to competition in the marketplace. And I think what DOJ told the Department of Consumer and Business Services is you have to disclose the rate filings because you can't argue that it's injurious to competition, that that argument did not hold. So I would be interested in having you guys take a second look at this memo and get back to me whether or not you still believe the Kirsch matter means that you don't have to provide public records in this matter.
So, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, thank you for this time today. I believe I know the letter you're referencing.
Your name?
Lynn Saxton, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. Can you give me the date of the letter and who it was sent to? I don't have it before me.
Yes, August 25th, 2015, to Kelly Knivla at Stoll Reeves.
So with regard to that letter, I certainly am happy to check with our attorney. So we can get back. Her name is Renee Steinman, and probably I'll just have her respond directly to you. I'm happy to answer all of the questions you asked and any other questions there are, but I know we're anxious to wrap up. Obviously, we have in the redevelopment of 2015 rates, which was, we all agree, collectively is not a desirable process. However, we do have to have rates. We do have to have rates approved by CMS. We will be working with the CCOs tomorrow, Thursday, not tomorrow, to begin looking at the 2016 rates. I've looked at the preliminary data. I think the CCOs are going to see sustainability there, number one. Number two, one of my goals when I started this job at the end of January was to ensure that all the partners to Oregon's health transformation leaned in. And I want to thank the committee today for leaning in and going through the exhaustive discussion that rate setting requires. And we will have more information available to you this week. So we'll look forward to sharing that with you. I and my office are happy to answer any questions anytime. We've been meeting individually with members, and we're happy to do that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it for everyone. All right. All right. The last agenda item is presentation on ambulatory surgical centers and extended care. Marilyn Dabrakow, Shelley Yuva, Catherine Seiler, and Chris Skagen.
Yes, and I think they're wrong in their interpretation.
Madam Chair, members of the committee.
1 minute, please.
Well, yes.
If you want your individual on the phone.
Yes.
Thank you. And it's still Catherine. Right, okay.
This is Kathy.
Kathy, this is Sandy Teeley Circa of the Senate Healthcare Committee.
Hello.
Hi. You are before the committee right now, and your panel is going to begin its presentation.
Okay, wonderful.
Thank you.
Doug Riggs.
Yeah. Again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Doug Riggs on behalf of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. We really appreciate you taking the time. We were prepared to talk about the OHA rate setting process for ASCs, but that looks like a controversial topic, so I think we'll put that off until some future date and time.
I didn't notice.
We have a much smaller panel of witnesses, and hopefully we can get through this relatively quickly. I did want to say that this is in part a follow-up to an effort that we had last session. We had a bill, House Bill 2507, introduced by Representative Williamson, which was heard in the House Healthcare Committee, and then we were directed to go into a work group setting, which we did for about a month and a half, and we came up with a much more pared-down version of the original proposal. So we view that as a good starting point, and we wanted to update the committee as to where we are. I think I'll turn it over to Chris and have him give you a quick overview of the national trends that we think are leading us in this direction.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Goggin. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. So currently we are talking about, I love to be close to the mic. So, as Doug said, we're here to discuss the extended stay recovery centers. So currently in Oregon State, we have the license for ambulatory surgery centers. That mandates it's less than 24 hours to align with conditions for coverage for Medicare. What we propose to have is an extended stay recovery center that mimics what you see in Colorado and several other states. It would give up to 72 hours for the extended recovery of the patients after they are discharged from the ambulatory surgery center environment. The overall goals are to have excellent clinical outcomes, increase in patient satisfaction, cost savings for employers, patients, and insurers, and overall just a better experience for the patient. I'd like to actually pass it off to Kathy to give a little insight as to how the facility operates in Colorado.
Great.
Thank you.
Kathy, you're on.
Oh, thank you so much. I have a little bit of a hard time hearing, so if I don't talk when I'm supposed to, you just let me know. But anyway, I'm Kathy Seiler, and I'm the Director of Clinical Operations at the Harmony Surgery Center in Fort Collins. We have had both our ASD Blessed Center license since we opened 15 years ago. We are a multi-specialty center who does many cases a year. We have 6 rooms in our extended recovery center, which we care for a variety of patients. We do total joints, we do gastric bypasses, we do plastic surgeries, general surgeries, and other orthopedics. Our average length of stay is probably right around 24 hours, although we do have surgeon preference sometimes prefers that patients stay longer than that, which is fine, and we always accommodate that. Patients have repeatedly stated how personal and individual the care is. Our patient satisfaction scores, like was previously mentioned, are excellent. We're able to provide them with a facility with an extremely low infection rate and being much more cost-effective than the hospital environment. Our care is very patient-centered, family-focused, and another huge point that the patients very much enjoy is the low nurse-to-patient ratio.
That's it?
Well, what else? What else?
No, this is wonderful. This is wonderful. We're at the end of a long afternoon.
I would love to answer any questions that you have or help you.
Just one. I would like to know you how many of your patients stay longer than 24 hours?
That's very variable. It really depends. I can tell you that our total joints, they do stay up to 48 hours. Very rarely do they go home after one day. And then also the gastric bypasses will frequently stay longer than 24 hours as well. But if we look at a lot of the plastic surgeries or some of the other the mastectomy patients, they're right around that 24 hours.
Okay.
So I would say probably an 80-20% if I had to throw that out.
Yeah, and on the slide here that we have before us that you can't see, it says 24% of the surgical patients stay one or more nights, and I was just wondering if that was consistent with yours.
That's pretty close. Pretty close. I would have to look to give you exact.
Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you. So the data set that I have here from the slides is from the Orthopedic Center of the Rockies, which does do a similar patient mix from Harmony Surgery Center that Catherine's on the phone there. Within the Orthopedic Center of the Rockies, they have 24% of their patients go through. So, again, about a quarter is typically what you see that would utilize this type of model.
And what kind of opposition did you have from the hospitals when you transition to more than 24 hours? Catherine, do you know? Or were you involved
well,
in
we
that?
Have never, we opened our facility with our convalescent license. And so, we didn't have a lot of opposition.
Okay.
We had, that little bit of competition, perhaps. But, you know, we've never had to transition that. Is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, I was just curious what that relationship was, because
we have a great relationship. You know, we have we're a joint venture. We're a 50-50 ownership with our health system, with our local health system, and it's we have a great relationship.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, again, when you review the trends in healthcare, you know, technology is improving as well as the techniques that are being used. We see in the private market, insurance companies, the federal agencies are asking that more be done in an outpatient setting. And other states are adopting rules to ensure that the safety, patient choice, predictability, and cost savings for the system are achieved. So currently, Oregon State does not have an opportunity like this, and we'd like to present a solution that we see would help expand out and encourage the high-value proposition for outpatient care. One of the examples for the private industry is a July 2015 United Healthcare bulletin that they actually require prior authorization for certain procedures. They do not require the same prior authorization for the ambulatory surgery setting. So again, this encourages the use for the most cost-effective utilization of surgical procedures while still ensuring the optimum patient outcome. And this is the list of that bulletin, just to give some perspective. Again, there's quite the wide array of different procedures that they are encouraging outpatient use when it's appropriate for the patient. And when we look at Medicare trends as well, within CMS, if you look at 1980, when they opened up the use of outpatient care, there really was a policy shift of trying to encourage the outpatient surgical procedures to help achieve cost savings for the patients while still also having excellent surgical outcomes from a quality aspect. When you look nationally, there are 5,300 Medicare-certified ambulatory surgery centers across the country. About 1,000 of those do have hospital relationships involved with that. So many times it's not an us versus them, that a lot of times you'll see that it's a little bit more complicated than that. Both the center that's on the phone as well as the Orthopedic Center of the Rockies both have relationships with the hospitals and very progressive partnerships where they will be utilizing the best outcome for the patient possible. And obviously, with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act, we're seeing a value-based purchasing program. Again, this is an overall theme of Medicare looking for the most cost-effective setting with the highest quality outcomes possible. It really aligns with the triple aim that we see here commonly discussed in Oregon. The acuity of care is also going up. CMS has approved 9 procedures this past year, so there are spine codes that are being done in Oregon State currently that are now done in the outpatient setting within ambulatory surgery centers. We've also seen current codes that are already approved but being utilized on a higher frequency within cardiac at the ambulatory surgery center setting. These have all had very high patient satisfaction. The infection rates are very low. Overall, I think it's been a success to see these done in the outpatient setting. When you look at the types of procedures that are being done, this is a list of procedures that at the Orthopedic Center of the Rockies, Harmony Surgery Center does very similar procedures as well. So total joints, your knees, your hips, your shoulders, they can do sports medicine, they can do a lot of the spine procedures as well. And this list is ever growing. Again, as the technology improves and the techniques improve, we're seeing the higher acuity of care cases done in the ambulatory surgery center environment. And this is a national bar to show kind of surgical trends and utilization. So really, since the 1980s to current, we've really seen this shift from the inpatient environment to the outpatient environment. Certain procedures like a gallbladder that originally would take multiple weeks of being out of work to recover, now you're seeing someone that they can come in, get the surgery done, and they may even be back to work within a day or two. It's really an amazing trend. So the extended stay recovery model, there's a handful of states around the country that have it. Really, Colorado has the most robust regulatory environment. I would encourage replicating something that we see within Colorado, mainly because we want to make sure that we're protecting the patient's safety. We want to work closely with OHA to make sure that the environment's set to have the most optimum outcome for the patients at the lowest cost possible. And so again, these numbers are from the Orthopedic Center of the Rockies. When you look at the average rate of reimbursement, it really is quite remarkable the cost savings potential that you can have by utilizing the outpatient environment. And these costs do include both the ambulatory surgery center component and the extended stay recovery component.
And I assume Kaiser Foundation health plans rates are so low because they have outpatient or ambulatory surgical centers.
Correct.
That is correct, Madam Chair. They do have two ambulatory surgery centers in Colorado. And this slide has a little bit of the indication of the quality measures. You know, when you look at the infection rates, you're talking about 3 in 1,000 that go to the hospital. So really, it's quite on par with what ambulatory surgery centers currently have within the Patient Safety Commission. Really, the complication rates and infection rates are on par with what you would see with just the ambulatory surgery centers in Oregon here. And again, the patient satisfaction, when you're looking at the high 90% patient satisfaction, that demonstrates the quality commitment that they have in Colorado that I could think we could replicate here in Oregon to really have, you know, high outcomes and help achieve cost savings, not only in the private market, but you know, as we see the trends current within Medicare, eventually seeing the same type of utilization in the outpatient market. I also wanted to share a little bit of a moment with Shelley Yuva here about the types of procedures that are done currently in Oregon within the outpatient setting.
Madam Chair, I'm Shelley Yuva.
Thank you.
And I'm the administrator of Slocum Surgery Center in Eugene. We're a 4OR proprietary surgery center performing only orthopedic procedures. I cannot share with you. I wish, and maybe you have had the opportunity to see the impact this has on the patient. We do orthopedics only, and we do total joints. Now, we do the healthy total joint patient. We don't take the complicated patient that could provide risk to the patient as well as the center. So we're doing a healthier population. These people are astounded at this care. They have almost privatized care. We are paid probably on the commercial market 30% of what a hospital is. We're just remarkably, it's appropriate resources. We don't have to have all of the hospital resources. These patients need surgical care. They need post-op management, pain and nausea. They aren't clinically vulnerable at that point, but post-op pain is an issue. That is something in my eye of this. Currently, these patients have to go home in 2359. Well, you kind of have to work the clock backwards to get them in the OR at the right time so that they can be discharged 2359. If we had additional time, those patients, our OR schedule could open up, which is good for the patients, good for the surgeon. We could maintain the patient and have time for them to do another round of meds, another ambulation. It's really just an additional security of what they're already achieving in the center. You know, if you have to be home at 2359, we may miss an opportunity to enhance care. We've been doing total hip patients. We have a home health component that goes into the home afterwards, reports and provides the care that Slocum creates the protocols. These patients are doing fabulous. Again, we have minimal overhead. We have private nursing in the center overnight for these. We have anesthesia. We have a contracted anesthesia team that's phenomenal. So the service that they get, the lack of risk to infection, which we're all aware of now, and I don't know if anybody on this committee has spent time in a hospital, it's kind of frightening. It really is a little bit of a frightening and overwhelming experience. Surgery centers are so user-friendly. As the client, you are at ease. You have the attention. It's not kind of this overwhelming, mechanical, frightening place. So I would like to see the opportunity to have this because we could continue to provide care. We could provide a little additional care because we don't have to get them out by 6 a.m. in the morning. And enhance the care the patient already has. I do not see moving a high medically risky patient into this setting. They belong at the hospital. As far as you had spoke to relationships with hospitals, Slocum has a very good relationship with both of our local hospitals, Sacred Heart and Mackenzie Willamette, and one of our surgeons started the total hip program at Riverbend. So we have a very collegial. As well, they're going to not be able to keep these patients because they are so expensive, and with their insurance payments, with Medicare, this patient for a hospital is a ridiculous expense. So again, appropriate resources and overhead for the provision of private quality service.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd like Chris to go back to the last slide because I do want to point out just a couple things. As I mentioned at the beginning of the process, the hospital that we had started out with a 72-hour window, and in the work group, we whittled that down to up to 48 hours. I believe the average stay in Colorado is about 32 to 36 hours. And so it gives some flexibility. So for a patient who stays more than 23.59 hours, the average stay is about 34 to 36. But we want that decision to be based on what's medically necessary for the patient, up to 48 hours. So that's the most important thing. I think another thing to point out is that even in Colorado, which has approximately the same number of ASCs, in the 10 to 12 years that this has been, and in fact, there are only
20 years.
So only 12 convalescent care centers. So they've been built up in the population centers to be able to meet the need. But they're prepared for the natural evolution in technology and the codes that are going to be opened up by Medicaid and Medicare. So we think that what we've come up with as a starting point is greatly narrowed from this point that we started last year. We'd be happy to answer any questions, and we certainly appreciate the time today.
Well, questions? Thank you very much. We'll expect a bill, I assume. Thank you, Kathy, from Colorado. I used to live.
Oh, you're so welcome.
I used to work at the University of Colorado Medical Center, know the area very well.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so I love Colorado. Anyway, thank you. And I'm
gonna very welcome.
Somehow turn you off, but I'm not sure what button. I don't know how to turn it off. Okay, thank you, everyone, and we're adjourned.